Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's not with us today, but she'll be back next week. And for those of you who are our faithful listeners, you know that Caroline is my mother. Today we have with us Jean K. Carney, author of Blackbird Blues. Jean spent 8 years as an award-winning reporter and editorial writer at the Milwaukee Journal, covering Children's Court, City Hall, and Roe v. Wade. She earned a Ph.D. in human development at the University of Chicago and trained at a large Chicago inner-city psychiatric hospital. She taught psychology at St. Xavier University, was director of a clinic, and supervised psychologists in training for 13 years. She was also in private practice for 30 years in the Chicago Loop. After her husband died of ALS, she edited his last book, Jewish Writing and the Deep Places of the Imagination, stopped publishing in professional psychoanalytic venues, and turned to fiction. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Jean.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Is Blackbird Blues your first book of fiction?
It is my first novel. I started writing short stories, but I went to the Sewanee Writers Circle, and I went to Breadloaf as well. And at both places, I was told, you shouldn't be writing short stories because the things that you're writing about are way too complex to capture in a short story. And I was steered really quite beautifully into writing novels. And I've always been very grateful for that a couple of really wonderful teachers at both Sewanee and Breadloaf steered me into novel writing.
Why do you think you started out with short stories?
Oh, because I didn't have the courage to tackle a novel. a novel seems like, that my husband who died was a literary critic, and he is sometimes said to be the last of the New York intellectuals. He was 10 years older than me, and he was, part of the Philip Roth circle, and he wrote on Lionel Trilling, and I was a bit intimidated by it, and I don't know that I would have actually written fiction I didn't even think to write fiction while he was alive. And I when I think about it, I think that partly I started writing stories to sort of keep something of him in my life, because I was writing stories before I met my husband. My husband now is a historian. They were both professors at the University of Chicago, but Konstantin Fosold is my husband now, and he's a historian of early modern European history, whereas Mark Krupnik was a literary critic and in the English department. So I think partly I began writing the stories as a way to hang on to him, but also because, losing a husband of 28 years is a tremendous gash in your life and in yourself. And I found that so many things just came up through that gash that I was writing down, and they began to sort of link themselves to each other. And I wrote a couple of short stories, and then Stuart Dybek said, enough with the short stories, you should be writing a novel. And he was one of the strongest forces for getting me away from the stories. And I didn't publish any of the stories. I still have them in the drawer. But when I came back from my last time I was at Breadloaf, I started writing Blackbird Blues in the car on the way back.
And was it did you have a short story on this with these characters that then grew into the novel, or did you start fresh?
No, what happened is Constantine and I were at a jazz performance here in Chicago at the Jazz Showcase, and I saw a jazz drummer, a young man, moving very rapidly back and forth, doing through the drum and the xylophone and all of that. And he reminded me, suddenly I saw in him a young man whom I visited in the children's home back when I was a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal, whom I used to visit because this young man, I covered the story, he had killed his teacher. And at the hearing for this guy, I think he was, probably 12 years old, maybe he was 13, but he was a young boy, really. And he had gone up to the teacher at the end of the class, picked her up, turned her over upside down, and smashed her head head first into a wastebasket and snapped her neck and killed her. So he was taken to the children's home, and at his hearing, the only person who came to his hearing was the public defender and me. And so I took to going to visit him at the children's home where he was placed. No one ever came to visit him at the children's home except me. So I would sit and talk with him, and he would move his hands and his feet, the grid on the floor, the grid on the table, and make, you know, music in quotation marks, just the way that reminded me of this guy that was making music. And so he sort of morphed in my mind now, so decades later, when I was sitting with Constantine listening to jazz at a time when things were bubbling up for me, and I was thinking about writing into the character Benny in my novel Blackbird Blues. So the first character I created was Benny. Now, Benny doesn't kill anybody, and he doesn't, you know, he certainly doesn't kill a teacher or do anything that dramatic, but he was the start of the novel, and then I began making, other characters came up to join him.
And that's interesting, because Benny isn't even the protagonist.
No, he's not, but he's a very important part of the novel, though, because he's Lucius's son. So he's a link between Sister Michaeline and Lucius. And, you know, at the end of the novel, he sort of pulls things together, too, because, I don't want to tell the end of the novel.
No. Now, the novel is set in the 1960s, primarily, although there's a lot of flashbacks to the 1940s as well.
Because of the Diary of the Nun, yeah.
Right. And it is very much, I mean, the Catholic Church and becoming a nun is very much a part of the theme of this novel. Were you raised Catholic, and did you want to become a nun?
Yes. I was raised Catholic, and nuns were very important to me. My family moved, how many times did my family move? I think it was, counted it up, and it's in my press kit. My family moved
10 times before you were 9.
Yes, 10 times before I was 9 years old. And in every single time, my mother insisted that I should be in a Catholic school. I mean, because some of these, obviously, I think it was 3 different first grades and 2 different second grades and a different third grade and a different fourth grade. And then finally, we stopped, and we were in Chicago because there was no more place for my dad to get promoted to. He was now at the top of the company, so that was it. But In Denver, they couldn't, we weren't there long, we were only there 6 months, but I was in a public school, so there was no nun. But all the rest of them, I was in a Catholic school, and of course the nuns were aghast that I was moved around like this. And so they really took me under their wing, and I got to know these nuns really well. And back in the day, you know, I'm 70 years old, so in the days before Vatican II, I don't know how much the readers will know about the Vatican Council that ran in the mid-60s. I think it was 62 to 65, something like that.
I don't know how much most listeners, but I was, I do remember the Mass changing from Latin to English. So that's what I remember from that.
And also,
and I would have been like seven or something. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you do remember. And,
yeah.
And changing, turning the altar around so that it faced the parishioners.
Yep.
Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
You used to have the back to the
I do remember that. Yep.
And there were huge changes, but one of the things that was changed is that back in the day, a person could enter the convent at age 13.
Oh.
And I did. I was actually, I was what was called at that time an aspirant. So I was in the convent from 1962 to 1966. And then the Vatican Council finished up, and the nuns actually encouraged all of us to go out into what was called into the world and get our college and all that. And then if we still wanted to become a nun, to come back. But of course, then I went to college and I became a journalist, and I got a job immediately at the Milwaukee Journal, and I was off and running with my career and got married and the rest. And I stay in touch with my class, and almost all of us were 108 of us who entered at 13 in my class, and almost all of us became social workers, psychologists, teachers, or some other kind of helping thing.
but not nuns.
I would say about, out of the 108, about 10 became nuns, but then over the years it left fewer and fewer. And then I think now we're down to, unfortunately, at the last reunion, at our 50th reunion, one of my dearest friends went home, and the next day went down to Mississippi to her mission and was murdered. And there were only, I think, three of us left who were still in the convent, and two of them are fatally ill with cancer. So we aren't going to have any anymore soon. But
wow.
We all the rest of us stay in touch and are, you can imagine, you know, someone who would do something like that at that age. We're still Franciscans. It was a Franciscan order.
Mm.
And so it's very much a part of our lives.
So that's something I wanted to talk to you about, because you obviously have a strong faith, and enough that you wanted to be a nun. And yet you're writing about really what I would call a pro-choice novel here.
Well, and then in my sense, the feeling that I had writing it is that it's not for or against abortion. It's for women doing what they need to do, because when I sat in I sat in the therapist chair for such a long time, and I had many, many patients who had to decide whether to keep a pregnancy or not. And one of the things I learned is that the whole abortion conversation in the country is always about, is it right or wrong? But nobody ever talks about, what about this person? I have had any number of patients say they wish they had never been born, that they were not wanted. They knew from very young on that they were not wanted, and their lives have been a misery. That it's not such an open and shut case, that it's always the best to bring a child into the world who's not wanted.
Yeah. And then, there's the whole, you know, various health reasons that women need to have abortions, you know, actual physical life and death situations sometimes.
All of that. And yeah. Then there's incest.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the heartbreakers, you know,
yeah.
when young girls who've been raped by their dads are forced to then give birth to a child. I mean, those just break your heart.
Yeah. And for the girl and for the child too.
Yes. What kind of a start in life is that? Because it's not like, oh, well, they'll never know, or I suppose you can give them away. But I guess I don't think of this as a pro-abortion book. I think of it as not taking a stand, but as being saying it's neither for nor against. That's how I think of it. It's certainly not against abortion, but I don't think of it as for.
Well, I don't think most people are like pro-abortion, like we want more abortions. I don't think that's the case. I think it's, like you said, it's nuanced. It has to be based on the individual situation. And ideally, that we would never have a need. No one would feel the need.
Yeah,
nobody,
exactly.
Yeah, but there's a lot
No one would be in that spot. Where
nobody
they
would be
to.
In that spot.
Well, then when I covered Roe v. Wade, I've written this down somewhere. I don't know if it was, it appeared in any materials that you've seen, but at the time when Roe v. Wade was passed, most of the women that I interviewed at the time, even if they themselves would never want to have an abortion and said they probably never would, they felt that it was important that it was available to women so that they wouldn't have to do something back alley and get themselves killed.
Or feel trapped.
Yeah.
You know, go ahead and have
like
this
said,
child, but feel trapped by it. Yeah.
And not have a choice, exactly.
Exactly. I never...
And the statistics are very clear that most people think it should be available, even if they themselves don't think they would ever either don't think they ever would avail themselves of the option, or that they hope they never would avail themselves. But I you know, I'm prepared for... I mean, so far, have you looked at the reviews of the book on Amazon and, you know, on the web?
No,
so
I
far,
haven't seen that. So far, you haven't gotten anyone pushing back on you about this?
No.
That's,
and I'm surprised. And
yeah.
These are not reviews from friends. They're total strangers. One is from a friend. But the rest of them are from people that I don't know who they are. And I've been amazed. I thought I was going to get hammered for this.
Well, what made you be brave enough? You know, why did you decide, okay, I may get hammered by this. I'm putting something out there that's controversial, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Because that's been the story of my life. I mean, I was an editorial writer. I wrote an editorial in... When I was an editorial writer at a very young age, at a time when women were not on editorial boards. I went to the big editorial conference for United States and Canada, and I didn't see any other women there. I mean, my editor was a trailblazer, and they were very good to me there. I was very, very, very blessed. But I wrote this editorial because there was a judge and you can look it up. It's his name is Archie Simon, and he was a judge in Wisconsin who said from the bench that a woman who was raped, he said from the bench in a trial of a guy who was accused of raping her, that she asked for it because she was wearing an outfit that was, I forget the exact words she used, but that her clothes were not modest enough and that she asked for it. Well, I wrote a scathing editorial about it, and it was picked up by a group of people who laminated it and put it I'm not pulling up the name of what it is, but a piece of paper that was circulated, and signatures were collected, and he was impeached.
Oh, a petition.
Yes, a petition.
Yeah.
And he was...
Wow.
At the time, it was the first judge ever impeached in Wisconsin. You know, so because I was a newspaper reporter, and I did a lot of really risky things. I covered the mafia. I would go out to the house in the inner city and... talk to people whose kids had just been killed, and you know, in my 20s, when I look back and think about the things I did when I was in my 20s at the paper, this novel is really tame compared to the stuff I did at the newspaper, both on the editorial board and as a reporter, because I was just fearless. But when I had the paper behind me, it was easier because, you know, the journal would, I remember getting pulled in because I wouldn't reveal my source for one of my stories. And they were going to, the district attorney's office was going to, had said that they were going to put me in jail until I revealed my source, but my editor said, "Do you really think they're going to put a 20-something young woman in prison for not revealing her source?" I said, "You just stand pat." And I did. And eventually they just let me go.
Now, let me pause here and let our listeners know that this is Writers' Voices, and we're speaking with Jean K. Carney, author of Blackbird Blues. Now, I thought there's like constitutional protection about that you don't have to reveal your source. And yet you do see or hear of reporters going to jail over it. So is there a protection or not?
Well, this would have been early 70s. And I don't know what... I don't know what the thinking was, but this was the government. This was the district attorney's office the state's attorney's office in Wisconsin that was doing this. It wasn't some other agency. So it was the government itself.
Sometimes it is the government itself who violates our civil rights.
Yeah, well, recently we've come to understand that.
A lot. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, who says, you know, when you're standing there and they're telling you that you're going to be taken off to jail, it seemed quite real to me at the time, but I stood my ground because my editor told me to. I said, well, I wouldn't mind being in the women's prison up at Techeeta because think of the stories I could get there. And he said, "We're not letting you go to prison. Forget about it."
So you covered Roe versus Wade for the Milwaukee Journal. That seems like, you know, something that maybe would be a national press or something, but did city papers, was it such a big deal that smaller city papers covered it? Wow.
Right. Well, but the Milwaukee Journal was the main paper for all of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, all the smaller cities in Wisconsin had their own newspapers.
Right.
Newspapers are dying out now, but back in the day when I was there in the 70s, newspapers were a big deal. And so it was fun for me because I remember one time going up way up to almost to the top of Wisconsin and sitting, I went up there with a friend for something, and there were people talking about my front page story that day up in, I've forgotten the name of the town, but it was a small town in Wisconsin. But it was the paper of record for all of Wisconsin at that time. Now it's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, because the morning paper was the Sentinel, and they merged with their own. There's just one paper.
Right.
Newspapers are dying out.
Yeah, it's a shame because you don't get the diversity of opinions and the diversity of perspective.
As you said, the local news. Yes, that was huge local news, Roe v. Wade.
Wow. Did you actually get to go and hear Sarah Weddington argue?
No. Sometimes, I did make some trips to Washington, D.C. Mostly we would cover local angles on things.
Right.
There were, awfully good stories going on in Milwaukee, tremendously good stories. There was a story of the story that took all the put all the homeless people back on the streets. I covered that, and that was a great story. I'm trying to remember the name of the woman who she sued the government because she was forced to stay in a mental institution, and she was a teacher. And the decision was that went all the way to the Supreme Court. She was a Milwaukee native, and the decision was, yes, she had to stay in she did not have to stay in the mental institution. So I went out and interviewed her, and she really needed, as a psychologist now looking back on it, and I knew it even then, you didn't have to be a psychologist to know that she needed some serious treatment. But then they opened the doors to all the mental institutions and let all these people out without giving them any treatment. And that's when the homeless crisis started. And that was a Milwaukee case. So it's an example of, some interesting things that came out of reporting that were local stories, but that had national implications.
Well, Jean, let's get back to your novel, Blackbird Blues.
Okay.
It's, like we mentioned earlier, set primarily in the 60s with some flashbacks into the 40s, and the main character is a young woman named Mary Kay who is considering becoming a nun. That's sort of always been her path, but she decides to experiment a little bit before going into the convent and finds herself pregnant. And at the same time, her mentor, nun, Sister Michaeline, is killed in an accident. And that's not any spoilers, because that all happens within the first chapter or two. You find all of that out. Why don't you read us a little bit from the book?
Around the bend, ahead on the expressway, toward the city center, red taillights snaked as far as she could see. The road looked as slick as a mirror. Next to her, on the side of the car, rain pelted and pierced the puddle. How could something look so dazzling, so mesmerizingly smooth when it was far down the road, and look so blown to smithereens up close? They sat on the Edens waiting for the traffic jam to unwind. She said fervently, "No matter what happens to the rabbit test, I don't want to get married." "Give me a chance. We haven't even talked." He put the gear in park and revved the engine. "We've got no business getting married, and you know it. We're nowhere near old enough." She stuck her arm out the window and slapped her hand on the roof of the car. There's nothing to talk about. I'm not getting married. You may change your tune when you actually hear what the rabbit test said. She was not going to cry. Frantically, she tried to calculate in her head. It would be 9 months from April 7th. Or did you start counting from your last period? She switched the radio off. I bet I'm pregnant. How long have you known? I thought you'd tell me right off tonight if you had results. An ambulance roared up the shoulder of the road alongside them, siren wailing. No wonder traffic wasn't moving. A car had crashed not far away on the other side of the median, going the other direction. In her mind's eye, she could see the ambulance, its back doors wide open. She could see inside. Somebody was lying on a stretcher. She could not help but wonder about that person. She couldn't see him or her, and she might not ever know the identity of that person, but he or she, or maybe it was they, had become part of her life, and at that moment they were holding up her life. She wanted them out of the way. She felt that clearly. She was numb, but her thoughts were not in a jumble. It was a little cooler after the rain, but the vent kept bringing in exhaust and soot. The air did not feel clean. Traffic began to inch forward. Let's go someplace and talk. I don't want to go someplace. I want to go to the Jazz Emporium. Sister had trusted Lucius enough to give him her book, and she was going to put her faith in him, too. She had a big problem, but she did not need to be alone with it. How did I get roped into driving in a colored neighborhood? Trying to please you again. I could care less about jazz music. Well, then why don't you drop me off and drive home? I don't need you to hold my hand and complain about the music. I can get back on my own. You think I'm going to leave you alone in this jungle? You got to be kidding. I'm not kidding. I've had it with the snide remarks and the Mr. Big Man performance. Watch your mouth, little lady. You're pushing your luck. She could not stand the sight of him. How could she have gotten mixed up with a guy who had scored a C in algebra, barely finished high school, whose father was connected with shady people? For God's sake, at the age of 19, Tony even had his own bookie. They drove in silence for a long time until she could stand it no longer. Tony, you're not watching the signs. You've got to get off at 47th Street. He cut across two lanes of traffic, nearly got rear-ended by a moving van, and skidded onto the exit ramp. You say you don't want to get married, so what's going to happen? I'll be damned if I'm going to be stand by and let a stranger raise my baby. It's not about you. I'm the one who's going to have a baby. We're not talking about what you're going to do. We're talking about what I'm going to do. I'm trying to talk sense, and you're stuck in la-la land. Typical girl. Doesn't give a damn about me. It's my baby, too, you know. She bit her tongue. He turned the radio on again. Dick Biondi took them through Walk Like a Man, My Boyfriend's Back, and Can't Get Used to Losing You. They drove down 47th Street, Mary Kay reading the street numbers aloud. Slow down, she said. You're going to pass it. You know what? He exploded. I don't need this. Have it your way. You keep treating me like I'm an idiot. I'm not going with you. I'm not going to listen to that god-awful music. I'm going to drop you off, and then I'm driving home. See how you like going in there all by yourself. Watch me. He had rattled her, but she was not going to back down. When they pulled up to the club, she got out of the car, slammed the door in the middle of Andy Williams. She could hear that Tony had not pulled away yet from the curb, but she kept walking. She followed a group of couples to the vestibule. A young black man dressed to the nines held the door for her, and she followed his date into the darkness. So this was the Jazz Emporium. He was too furious, and too shaken up to look for the place under the photo of Billie Holiday alongside the Steinway. She grabbed a chair at the end of a row of tables and swiveled to check out the crowd. Blacks, whites, and mixed couples bowed over cocktails, reading newspaper reviews of Chicago jazz greats laminated on the tiny tabletops. Early arrivals had nabbed raggedy brown leather love seats along the walls under photos of Armstrong, Goodman, Krupa, and Hines, familiar faces from Sister Michaeline's class. Some perched on the sassy hot pink leather and rattan stools around the mahogany horseshoe bar in the back. She wondered how many others had got in with phony IDs. The white pianist intoned the first bars of It Could Happen to You.
And that was Jean Carney reading from Blackbird Blues. So are you a jazz lover, Jean?
Yes.
I thought so.
I am, very much so.
Did you have to do much research on these time periods to get the details right, or particularly in the 60s, since you were a young woman during that time, did your memory suffice?
I didn't do a lot of research on the 60s because I lived through it. But I did refresh my memory, somewhat. Where I did more research was on Lucius's background, and I had a very good time with that, because I did not know anything about the fact that, I mean, I knew that African Americans could not serve in the military with white people in World War I. I already knew that, because they were such ferocious fighters and such effective fighters. And Lucius in the novel has a mentor who's a Frenchman who realized that Lucius's talents and groomed him as a military person, but also taught him cooking, or arranged for him to learn French cooking, and became his mentor really throughout his life. And I had a lot of fun with that. And when Lucius came back, he came back just in time, as all of these guys did, for the 1919 race riots, which were horrible, and which I really didn't know that much about, but which were very, very interesting to learn about. Carl Sandburg has a wonderful book, The Chicago Race Riots, that anybody, even people who aren't interested in Chicago, I think would find. It's a slim little book, but it's absolutely fascinating.
Were the race riots just in Chicago, or were they more widespread?
I believe they were more widespread. I didn't do a lot of research into anything outside of Chicago, though, and they were fierce enough in Chicago that it warranted this the book.
How did you write your black male characters?
Well, you know, I had some help. I wrote to the best that I could based on African-American people that I knew. I lived in Hyde Park for a long time because that's where I did my PhD work, and then I lived there for until my husband that I mentioned before, who died. And so we had, that's an interracial neighborhood, so I had knew a lot of people who were African-American, but when I came time to actually writing the dialogue and to being sure that I was creating plausible characters, doing plausible things, I took those parts of the book, actually the whole book, to an African-American at the University of Chicago who specializes in African-American literature, and had him go through the whole book, but with special attention to the dialogue and actions of the African-American characters. And he gave me a couple of books in which African-Americans were writing letters to each other that helped me get dialogue from the same period of time that Lucius was from. And he helped me get the dialogue to be in line with what he felt it should be. And I trust him very much. And his name is Ken Warren, and he's a, you know, an expert in aside from being African-American himself, he's an expert in African-American literature of this period. So the period that I'm writing about, to me.
It sounds like you found the right person. So when you're talking about the black soldiers, the African-American soldiers in World War One, and how they actually were commanded by French officers and were able to, you know, participate more fully in the war and actually made quite a name for themselves. We had another author we interviewed a few months ago that this is featured in her book. It was Julie Berry. The book is called Lovely War, and one of the characters in it is a black soldier in World War One. It's all set in World War One. Yeah. So, Blackbird Blues, where'd the title come from?
Well, a couple of things. Blackbird is a slur for nuns. It was a slur for nuns back in the days when they were head to foot. You know what nuns
were like. Right, right.
Yeah. And some people call them blackbirds. Blues is from the music. And also, Bye Bye Blackbird was a song that figures, runs through the whole book.
So, how long did you spend writing this?
I think altogether, including the many revisions, because I began writing it when I was still in full-time private practice, I think in 9 years.
9 years. And all along, were you aiming towards eventual publication?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. And what kept you motivated through that time?
I felt I had something to say. I wasn't sure what it was, but I felt I felt that my life was evolving in stages, that I had had, you know, my early life, which included the convent. Very, very happy years. I've mentioned that in the press kit. Some of the happiest years of my life. Then my 10 years as a newspaper. And then my, whatever it is, 30, 40 years as a, in psychology. And I knew writing Blackbird Blues helped me retire. Because I could feel that there was something erupting in me, you know, when I told you about seeing that drummer at the jazz showcase, and then having the memory of the kid from the children's home so many decades earlier, moving his feet and his hands at the children's home. Making music that reminded me of the same motions, I felt a continuity of my life, and I felt that somehow the phases of my life were stacking up. And it just seemed to me that I needed, that I was going to be leaving seeing patients and going back circling back to writing, only writing, not covering stories, you know, for the newspaper, which are fleeting. I mean, that's one thing that wasn't satisfying about being at the newspaper, which is the reason I left the newspaper in the first place, that you start all over fresh with the news, and you have to write about things that are happening at the, what you're writing about is dictated by what's happening in the news. So you're not writing about what's happening inside you. You're writing about what you're writing about is dictated by the news.
True.
And yeah. So here I was now closing in on the end of my life. And I wanted to circle back and pick up that strand of writing, but to do it on my own terms. Now, what was the question?
What kept you motivated through 9 years? But that's a very good answer.
So I wanted to pick up, because my careers are all connected. When I went to the newspaper, and I got people to talk to me, and I put it in the newspaper for everybody to read. And then I went into psychology, where I used the same skills to get people to talk to me, but I told absolutely no one at the pain of being put in prison.
Right.
And now I'm getting myself to allow myself to talk to me, and I'm putting it out for everyone to see who wants to see. And I feel like I'm closing the circle.
So, Jean, you're being published. The book, has it come out already? Has it been released?
Oh, yeah. It came out October 1st.
All right. And we're talking on October 10th or 11th. So, you're 10 days now as a published author. A published novelist. Does it feel any different?
Yes, it does, because I've been astonished by the reviews on Amazon and very gratified. I didn't expect the reviews to be as good as they are. I mean, you know, you expect your friends to write good reviews, but these are people I don't even know. And they're...
And how are they finding out about Blackbird Blues?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure.
Well, that's good.
One review is on something called, you must see this review by Ellen Mirapol. Now, I know her. She and I met at Breadloaf, and she's written something on something called Egg. I forget, but it's, Google Blackbird Blues and see reviews, you'll see some of them, but you'll see a number of them on both Amazon and, Barnes & Noble.
Okay. And how did you get published? Did you have an agent, or are you self-publishing, or how's it working for you?
I'm not self-publishing. My publisher is Bedazzled, Inc., and it was very hard. I tried hard to get an agent, but I'm a nobody, and everybody said, oh, this is great, someone's going to snap it up, but no one did in terms of an agent, and I... sent to, you know, lots and lots of presses, and they all said, you know, this is an intriguing idea, but it's not quite right for us. And I began to think that maybe the abortion thing was too hot for them. And then when Bedazzled took it immediately, I said, aren't you worried about the abortion thing? And they said, we love throwing bombs. That's what she said. So, I mean, they were aware. But so far, I mean, you know, nobody's picketing my house or anything yet. So,
can you tell us a little bit about Bedazzled Inc., who's behind it, and how long they've been around? And looks like they've been doing this a while when looking at their website.
Oh, yeah. It's a feminist press. I don't know what else to say. I admire the things that they publish, and that's why I went with them, because they do take chances on things that are controversial, and they publish social and culturally meaningful things. They don't publish silly stuff, or, you know, what can I say?
Well, they said they're dedicated to literary fiction, nonfiction, and children's books that celebrate the unique and underrepresented voices of women, and books
there
about
you go.
Women. Yep.
That's what they do. That is what they do. And they do it very well.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And it looks like they've been in business since 2004.
Yeah, they're quite. They have a short but I think impressive list.
Yeah, certainly looks like it. We'll have to look for other books there.
Yeah, I mean they have things that are really worth reading. I mean it's hard for me to talk about it because I'm one of the authors.
And I'm looking like they have one of the independent publisher book awards, they published. And so it's an independent publisher. And what is working with them like? Is it, do they do a lot of editing?
They have an excellent editor in Casey. And they have a wonderful liaison person in Liz. Now I can't remember her last name. Elizabeth might be Gibson, but I'd have to look it up. It should probably on their website. She's wonderful, easy to work with. Yeah, they're easy to work with.
Great, great. And do you have did they do the cover?
Yes, they did.
Did you have any input in that?
Absolutely. They did one cover, which I didn't like at all, and we talked about it, and they did another one, and finally we came up with this one, and we all loved it.
Great.
They have been extremely attentive to to my input, and anything that I feel strongly about, they've accommodated me.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So what's next for you in your writing life, Jean?
I'm not sure. I've been so, I mean, I have a couple of things in the back of my mind for ideas for the next novel. I mean, I think that's probably what will happen. We're going to New York and Los Angeles with the book. And, you know, for readings in Chicago. So I've been so busy in terms of the publicity side of it. And I can't say enough about JKS Communications. They are, you know, if people ask you about who's a good publicist, they are off the charts wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. I work with five or six of their, of the people there. On books, so
yeah,
I've had nothing but good experience with them.
Yeah, they're sensational.
Yeah.
And but I don't I'm not in the middle of another book, if that's what you mean. I'm in the early stages of thinking. I mean, I wondered if I should do a sequel, but I don't think so. I'm not sure I have much more to say about these folks, but. You never know.
You may come back to that later. You know, yeah, like you said, you never know. So Jean, one thing we didn't really talk about too much, but another very important theme of the book is the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And, you know, Mary Kay as, you know, coming from a background that had no kind of did not empathize, the people she was around did not empathize with civil rights or the need for it other than the nuns. And nuns really were important in the civil rights movement, weren't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think a lot of people our age will, well, certainly people who grew up in Catholic schools will immediately identify with that. And there were, I think that my dad was not the only dad who was like the dad in my in the book. There were lots and lots of, you know, it took a while, I think, for the generation above me to come round.
I know. And to think, I mean, the attitudes towards people of color that are exhibited by Mary Kay's family and even some of her own peers, we forget that's what it was like just 50 years ago. And probably still is in some places today, but that was just totally accepted to be that bigoted 50 years ago.
It was. And so you think that didn't seem exaggerated to you in my depiction of it, huh?
No, it did not. I mean, Archie Bunker.
Yep, good old Archie Bunker. There's a reason why he was on the tube at the time.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, and my parents were, my dad was born in Emmitsburg, Iowa. My mother was born in Fort Dodge, and they were living in Fort Dodge when they met, and my dad came back from the war and moved to Fort Dodge, and then I was born in Fort Dodge. We didn't stay there very long, but we also lived in all these 9 places that are 10 places that I lived was Carroll, Iowa.
Oh, wow. So you've got some Iowa roots. Well, Jean, we're out of time, but I really enjoyed speaking with you today. And I believe that sometimes controversial issues being presented in as a novel can actually change people's attitudes.
Well, I hope you're right. We'll see, huh?
Yeah, we'll see. Thanks so much for being with us today, Jean, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.